You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mark Bittman has been on the show many times to talk about his various roles as a cookbook writer, television chef, New York Times columnist, blogger, how-to video star, and food activist. His latest project is an updated version of his classic cookbook, How to Cook Everything, this time with 1,000 color photos that take the reader step-by-step through 185 recipes. How to Cook Everything, The Basics, is published by Wiley, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Mark Bittman back to our show.
Always great to be here.
I was tempted to say your various toques, but you've said many times in the show that you're not a chef.
I used to have to go out in front of people and insist that I wasn't a chef, but somehow now I seem to have succeeded in making that distinction. Perhaps it's my lousy technique.
Do you really think you have bad technique?
Because I have bad technique.
Were there many retakes on the photos here or when you do the videos?
Well, if I take my time, I can do things the way they're supposed to be done, but also I do emphasize that it's not important to have good technique to be a decent cook. But, chefs are in a different league, as they should be. They're producing food for hundreds of people every day.
And chefs do have to get the technique down. That's why Jacques Pepin wrote his La Technique and La Méthode books. He says, if you start off with good technique, everything else follows.
I think that's true. But again, I would distinguish between chefs and home cooks who, it doesn't really matter how much you butcher that onion, the dish will be fine.
The big problem for me is that it takes me forever to butcher that onion. And chefs go, they take mushrooms and go, I'm
I think that's something we all experience, but if you figure over the course of a 45-minute recipe or whatever, it takes you an extra 5 minutes to do the chopping, so what?
Did the idea for this book grow out of the how-to videos that you posted on the internet and on the New York Times?
Actually, when I first wrote How to Cook Everything, there was a percentage of the audience, I can't say how big, but there was a percentage of the audience that would say, I don't know anything, and this book is overwhelming. I want pictures. I want the most basic recipes. I got that message and spent some time. This isn't just a reduced version of the Big Red Book. It's new stuff, but obviously the big feature is the 1,000 photos.
Although this is not just aimed at the novice cook, is it?
I think most people who like my style of cooking will learn how to do stuff from here. But not just aimed, but I'd say primarily aimed at new cooks, yeah.
Well, since you first published How to Cook Everything, you've gone on to become something of a food activist. Do the recipes in this new basics version reflect that change?
I think that I will never do a book that has as much emphasis on meat as the early cookbooks that I did. I mean, ironically, the first cookbook I did was called Fish, which is also problematic now. But these are very much traditional and basic recipes. There is plenty of meat. It's very much American home cooking. But there's an international flavor, and there's also a little bit of the sort of less meat attitude in here.
You do include some pretty basic things like how to poach an egg or to mince an onion. Were these things that you struggled with when you first started cooking?
Well, I still struggle with poaching eggs. It's funny, I know how to poach an egg, and I do an okay job of it. But I think, there is technique involved in that. One of the difficult things about this book is sort of where to draw the line. Do we really discuss how to boil water? Do we really discuss how to boil eggs, which are very, very basic? And the answer in many cases was there is such a thing as too much information, but here in this book, we opted to go more basic and more informative whenever it was possible.
Many years ago, a friend asked me to help write a cookbook of Mexican food. And when my version of my recipe for guacamole went to 5 pages. The publisher decided they needed somebody else to write it.
That might have been too much information.
But after you read that, you could not go wrong. There was everything you needed to know about how the knife should feel as it went through.
Sounds
the
like
avocado.
Literature.
it tickles your skin through the through the avocado
skin. Send it to me. I'd like to see
oh,
it.
It's gone somewhere. But you can't give people too much information.
You can, and you have to. You always have to. One of the challenges of recipe writing is you're trying to hit some kind of smart middle ground between someone who thinks, I just need to glance at this and I'll know what's going on, and someone who says, well, what do you mean? And we all know the joke, which is probably better told visually than on the radio, of saying separate the eggs, and the guy takes two eggs and puts one on one side of the table and one on the other. So,
and you do have pictures of separating
yes,
eggs.
Yes, that we have. Yeah. I think the pictures.
Is that something people have problems with? I only do when the eggshell breaks.
There's an assumption that cooks make that, you know, there are a lot of conventions in cooking, a lot of phrases that mean something to people who know how to cook that don't mean anything to novices. And the idea here is to try to make everything clear.
Well, one of the things you did with the minimalist columns was to pare down recipes for classic dishes. Have you done that here as well?
Well, in a way, I have no choice. Because I'm always in a hurry, like most people. I'm always in a hurry. I'm kind of lazy. And I often am running behind. So most things that I do get pared down.
Do you sacrifice anything by paring them down?
Well, that was the whole idea of the minimalist. And I did do the column for 13 years, so I've had some practice. The whole idea is to say, what can we leave behind and not lose the spirit of the recipe? And, I'm critical of the way I cook. I always see when I make mistakes. I always know when things could be better. I rarely think things are perfect. But, you know, I have something of a following, so I guess some of this is working.
Well, when you have guests coming over and you really want to impress them, do you still do something that is pretty basic?
Yeah, I have guests coming over tonight. All I know is I have a full refrigerator, and I feel like it'll be fine. Especially living in New York, but it's very hard to impress somebody who has the options that we all have, the restaurant options that we all have. So I'm not gonna compete with that. I'm gonna try to give people honest food that I don't kill myself making, so I can still have time enjoying myself.
But you've always been an advocate for eating at home, as wonderful as our restaurants are.
I prefer to eat at home, but it is a bit of a whirlwind here.
My guest is Mark Bittman, whose latest book is How to Cook Everything, The Basics, All You Need to Know, All You Need to Make Great Food. It has 1,000 photos, and it's published by Wiley. So if technique is not the most important thing, what is? Is it the best ingredients, good cookware?
No, I don't think any of those. The best ingredients, obviously, is the most helpful of the things you've mentioned. Most important, I think, are the things you mentioned. I think time and dedication. I mean, just a willingness to spend the time it takes to learn how to be a decent cook and to get the stuff on the table. That's the primary, especially these days when so many people have not grown up with a cook in the house. The willingness to dedicate the same amount of time you might dedicate to learning how to drive a car, for example, which means a number of hours, a number of tries, and enough patience to see what the wonderful enjoyment is behind cooking.
You recently blogged about a place called the Heart Attack Grill. Is that a real place?
Yeah, didn't the guy have a heart
what
attack
a name.
There?
Yeah, well, I was wondering, is that owned by Paula Deen, or would she have the might, diabetes grill?
Might be owned by a local cardiologist.
So they sell 6,000 calorie triple bypass burger. That's what they call it. They offer a special deal for people who are over 350 pounds. So they get to eat free. And you say somebody had a heart attack while eating there?
Well, I suppose there's some kind of humor and irony in this, but really, to me, it's just a giant symptom of what's wrong with the way we eat in general.
So why would anybody do that? Because they're proud of the fact that they're going against people like you?
I was in a town the other day in Mexico called Puebla, and they have a special liqueur. And if you drink 100 shots, you get them for free. So the only guy who ever did that went to the hospital also.
Yeah, well, alcohol poisoning.
Well, I guess there's such a thing as fat poisoning.
You keep your readers informed on food news of the weird, like 1,000-calorie bacon milkshakes?
You know, everybody's trying to make a name for themselves, and everybody's trying to distinguish themselves. So people are doing things in all kinds of directions.
After publishing Food Matters, what have you done to continue to spread awareness about the interconnectedness of food, health, and the environment?
This is like, what have you done for me lately?
No, but you obviously see these as all connected, and the environment plays a role in this as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I do have the weekly column in the Times now, the weekly opinion column, and there is way more than I can handle in that regard. And the news connecting environment, health, food, public health especially, it's just, it doesn't stop.
And then we keep on learning things. NPR ran a report this morning about arsenic in rice. It turns out that there's more arsenic in rice since somebody just recently tested rice, especially brown rice, than we would have imagined. And you had a blog post describing the FDA's Apple Act, which is about arsenic in juice.
There, you know, it's hard. It's hard not to. The challenge is to not overblow every alarmist thing that comes down the pike, and to sort of let things sit for a little while and see: is this real? Is it actually something we should be nervous about? I think that food safety in general is a huge issue, and as the FDA's budget doesn't grow and sometimes gets cut, I think we have more and more challenges in that regard. You know, the cantaloupe listeria outbreak of a couple of months ago killed almost 40 people. That's a scary thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe in arsenic in moderation, but
it's a stimulant. What's the story?
Actually, the real concern is for children who drink rice milk and have cereals with a lot of different rices in them. They're just small traces, but still, nobody ever thought to look for arsenic in rice. And I suspect that if we started looking for bad things in other foods, we might be shocked. That's why that listeria outbreak was so shocking to us all.
Yeah, I think that. What can I say? I think that the budget for food safety should be growing by leaps and bounds, especially as there are fewer and fewer controls over the companies that produce food.
In a recent column, you wrote, sugar is cheap, sugar tastes good, sugar sells, so companies have little incentive to change.
You can put sugar into almost anything and increase its popularity. And if you increase its popularity, you increase your profit margin. Sugar is cheap. So how in the long run, how do we deal with that? How do we prevent food companies from lacing everything with as much sugar as it'll hold?
A little bit of sugar is okay.
Well, you know, again, this in a way, this ties nicely into home cooking, because if you cook at home, it's very unlikely that you're going to cook with 150 pounds of sugar a year. And most people go through a couple of 5-pound bags of sugar a year. We eat, on average, 150 pounds per person per year. That stuff is in processed food. That is not in baked goods you make at home or the teaspoon of sugar you put in your coffee. I mean, it's most people who put sugar in their coffee use one or two, or people who like it really sweet, 3 teaspoons. A Coke has 9 teaspoons. So if you think about putting 9 teaspoons of sugar in a cup of coffee, you get an idea of how quickly this mounts up.
So why do you think this has become such a political hot potato?
Well, because our obesity-related healthcare bills are roughly $150 billion a year.
Yeah, but and politicians are complaining about any kind of regulations on these things.
Yeah, well, that's a question for you to ask more political guests than me, I guess. But what we have are politicians who feel beholden to voters who claim to not want government, even though they do. You know, there is that famous poster, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." I mean, people are confused about this stuff.
On the other hand, trans fat intake has gone down over the last 10 years, hasn't it?
Yes, 50-something percent. I mean, regulation.
Is that because of regulation?
Yeah,
because
I think
of the campaign against
regulation works. People are trying to get trans fats. Trans fats, I was on a different show yesterday and with a doctor from San Francisco who described trans fats as the devil incarnate. Pretty strong stuff, but okay, let's just assume that the consensus is that trans fats are not good for you. Why would you not regulate them?
So when you put together recipes for a book like this, Are these all things you keep in mind?
Well, I've, you know, people used to ask me, still do, about the healthiness of my recipes. And I, again, I would defend, you know, real home cooking as opposed to here's how you cook with 300 calories per dish and you use all these phony things and whatnot. Real home cooking, using honest ingredients, whole foods, small W, small F, and some real judgment, which is not that difficult, and you're not going to poison yourself. I mean, the arsenic and the rice aside. I guess that's not funny.
Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything, The Basics, All You Need to Make Great Food with 1,000 Photos is published by Wiley. We will continue our conversation. We also invite your comments. You can write into us on our, at our website at WNYC.org, or if you want to give us a call, our number here is 212-433-9692. We'll be back with Mark Bittman right after this. We are back with Mark Bittman, whose latest book is How to Cook Everything, The Basics, All You Need to Make Great Food. It's published by Wiley. It used to be Wiley and Sons. We have a link to your espresso black bean chili, I think, do we? No, we have your bean burgers. You have a number of bean recipes here.
Yeah, well, beans are the wave of the future.
So putting coffee into chili does something really great?
Yeah, it gives it a sort of, first of all, it makes the color amazing, but it's also got this sort of nice, mysterious bitterness to it that's lovely. Bean burgers, you know, bean burgers are not easy to get right, but when you get them right, they're quite joyful because you think, wow, this is, I mean, I'm liking this. And then you feel like, oh, I'm doing the right thing, and I like it.
So. Well, traditionally, it's been mushrooms that people have used as a meat substitute for burgers.
And
what do beans do that mushrooms don't do, or should you mix the two?
Well, that's fine also. I mean, what's a burger? I mean, a burger is a patty. So anything that works for you that you can put between two pieces of bread and enjoy is fine. Mushrooms, yeah, I grew up in that era also. The fake burger made from mushrooms, or the eggplant cutlet, as you no doubt remember.
And Shake Shack is doing a mushroom burger right now.
I didn't know that.
Are there certain dishes that are worth making by hand rather than buying the supermarket version? For example, a soup stock. What is to be gained by making your own
soup stock? If you're going to – I mean, you know, my soup stock is totally worth making by hand. And I can say that as someone who's a real advocate for simplicity and taking it easy, because I honestly believe the best substitute for homemade soup stock is water. So that if you're not going to
don't buy that stuff in the supermarket.
Don't buy that
low
stuff.
Low sodium, high sodium.
Forget it. It's terrible. If you smell it, you don't even want to taste it. And if you taste it, no. You make chicken stock or you make vegetable stock, it's great stuff. The problem is, as soon as you make it, you use it because it's so good. You make a chicken stock, you think, I better make a risotto. And then, boom, half of it's gone. You make soup, the other half's gone. Now what? You go back to cooking and you just think, if a dish has a carrot in it and an onion and some celery and some meat or whatever, and you put water in there, it's making stock while you're cooking it anyway. So I'd say use water. That's the stuff in cans is just dreadful.
But a chicken stock is also a way of not throwing out a lot of stuff that you might normally throw out, because you can save those leaves from the celery or from the carrots. You can save those chicken bones instead of just throwing them out.
You know, it all depends on how frugal you are and how much time you want to take.
And how big your freezer is.
But you can take how big your freezer is. You can freeze all this stuff, or you can make a little bit of stock with what's left over on any given day and freeze that and use that as the base for making more stock.
What about croutons?
Well, certainly you're not going to compare homemade croutons to those things in the plastic bags. I mean, those are also dreadful. Those are less dreadful than canned stock, I would say. But there's nothing like cutting up a little stale bread and cooking it in olive oil. It's fantastic.
A caller wonders about your take on Dr. William Davis and his book, Wheat Belly, about the role of wheat in our diet and how it's changed over the years.
You know, I wouldn't consider myself an expert on this stuff, but I will say that highly processed food in general and processed flours that remove everything are probably not doing any of us any good.
Does it matter whether we're talking about Key Food white flour or King Arthur white flour?
I think it matters a little bit, but nutritionally it probably doesn't matter much.
So it's just a matter of whether it's ground better or a higher quality wheat?
Well, you know, King Arthur at least is unbleached, so there's that one less step of processing. But, you know, I think the difference is probably not as great as the price.
Mm-hmm. Do you watch the television shows?
Because no, I don't.
Because that's – well, you've done television.
But I don't watch mine and I don't watch anyone else's. Honestly, people come up and they say, do you see that – did you see that episode of Top Chef? And no, and I don't understand why you're watching it. But, hey, to each his own, right? I watch football.
But aren't there ways of learning – isn't that a good way to learn techniques? Watching Bobby Flay flay something?
Very cute. I honestly have not watched enough to know whether it's a good way of learning techniques, but I kind of – I mean, the food television that I have watched is mostly competition and cleavage. So I don't know what you're learning from that. You're not learning knife techniques.
Do you – there seems to be – have been a resurgence of attention to good food
we hope
in this
so.
Country.
Yes.
Do you think that that's true of the rest of the country, or is that limited to big cities like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco?
Obviously, it's more prevalent here, but there's been no place that I've gone in the United States in the last year or two where there isn't at least some place making some effort to do things well.
We, as I said earlier, we invite calls from our listeners. Our number here is 212-433-9692. If you want to speak to Mark Bittman, you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. What comments do you get from readers? Do they write to you a lot?
I get a lot on the blog, and sadly, I'm kind of thin-skinned, so I skim. The flattery, the really kind things are nice, but, it piles up, and it turns into a...
And then people can be nasty when they write in.
The web has allowed people to be... The web and the way television is these days has really allowed people to feel much freer and... terms of being insulting, and it's really no fun to be insulted. So I try to, I like to be responsive, and I like to see what people are interested in, but you also have to either develop a thicker skin than I have or stand back a little bit from the deluge of the sugar column I wrote in the Times last week, we had to close comments after 500 comments. This is in 24 hours. That's a lot to read.
What were people saying?
Well, of course, some people were saying, don't regulate food, but I would say the vast majority of people think something has to be done about the use of sugar in food. Something has to be done to control obesity.
But when the mayor wanted to put a tax on sugared drinks, there was a hue and cry that drowned him out.
Well, the hue and cry was largely sponsored by the beverage industry. So when the mayor has a PR campaign that can match the dollars that the beverage industry puts into these kind of things, soda taxes will start to pass. I mean, it came very close to passing in Philly a year ago, and the beverage industry poured millions of dollars into a campaign that scared people and said, oh, this is going to cost jobs, this is really a terrible thing, and it was narrowly defeated. I think that there's going to be something will happen in this world, and there will be a snowball effect because the benefits far outweigh the problems that it will cause.
A caller wonders about your take they erased it. Whether you were going...
Make it up!
No, I remember what the caller wanted to know. Whether you'd ever do a cookbook for elderly cooks because they have to be concerned about things that others don't necessarily have to worry about.
I would rephrase the question and say, am I ever going to do a cookbook for elderly cooks because we have to be concerned about things that I think it's definitely on the horizon. We were talking about it yesterday, in fact, because we were like, well, we're baby boomers. Here we are. We're in our 60s. We are going to be elderly cooks soon.
Do we have to cook differently? Are there certain things we should be avoiding eating?
The first thing I noticed about getting older and cooking is that I can't – my wrists aren't as strong as they used to be.
I have a lot like to sit when I do the cutting.
Cast iron is not as much fun as it used to be. you know, we're all going to have some problem or other, and we're going to try to address some of those things with food. And while food is neither a panacea nor the devil incarnate, as my friend said yesterday, I think there are ways that eating better can help us as we grow older.
Let's take some calls. Maria, hi, you're on the air. Maria from Manhattan.
Hello. My question has to do with vegetable stock. You, Leonard, a week ago, referred in some sense to using carrot tops. And I had heard somewhere that they are poisonous or slightly poisonous. So that's one question. The other is, aside from beet tops, which I do use, are there other greens that we throw away, like radish tops, for example, that we could use to make a vegetable stock?
Carrot tops are not poisonous, but they can be bitter, and I think that that's the general answer to your question, which is, do you want your stock to taste like radish tops? But that's the question, and if you do, fine, it's not a problem. There are things that I don't use, and radish tops are not an extreme example. I would use them in a stock, but
In small quantities.
Yeah, I wouldn't put a lot of turnip greens or mustard greens. Yes, I wouldn't put eggplant. I mean, broccoli. There are things you don't want your stock to taste like, unless you do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so if you're making a broccoli soup, then by all means, broccoli pairings would go into the stock that you're going to use for that. But if you're making a chicken rice soup of a sort of ordinary variety, you know, you want the sweetness of carrots and onions and celery and that kind of stuff.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Rachel asked, what do you think of using seaweed sheets or dried mushrooms for making stock?
Well, kelp, you know, you're talking basically about the foundation of Japanese cooking, which is a combination of seaweed and sometimes black mushrooms, dried shiitakes, sometimes bonito flakes, and that's a great thing. I do think that kelp or kombu is a wonderful addition to vegetable stock of the Western kind. Also, you just have to be careful not to boil it because that gets bitter also.
You have a recipe here for miso soup.
I have an upcoming story in the Times Magazine about miso because I think it's the most... miso is the Parmesan of the 21st century. Let's put it that way. Miso is a really underrated ingredient.
Can you make miso from scratch? Because it seems to me...
One can, but none of us ever will.
Because when I've gone to Japanese restaurants and ordered it, the range has been from, my gosh, this is unbelievable, to this is just some kind of flavored water.
And that's exactly the story of miso. There's it's like almost anything else. There's artisanal miso and there's brilliantly made miso, but you are not going to make it yourself. No, never.
So I have to buy some kind of a mix or...
No, you buy the good stuff, but, you know, there's a place on 9th Street that sells it. There's a place in Midtown that sells it. I mean, it's all over.
Andrea from White Plains is on the air. Hi, Andrea.
Good afternoon. I'd like to use more beans in my cooking, and I have a question about using canned prepared beans or whether it makes sense to use a pressure cooker to start from the dried beans.
Or whether it makes sense to just cook them is sort of the third option. I used canned beans not long ago. I can't remember the occasion, but I did. And, you know, I have no problem with canned beans, but I do... I'll remind you and I'll remind everybody else that it takes a little time to cook beans from scratch, but it doesn't take much effort. And yes, the pressure cooker, if you're a pressure cooker fan, the pressure cooker is a great way to cook beans.
You're not a pressure cooker fan?
I find it's easy enough to just put a pot of beans on the stove, turn the heat really low, walk away, and come back an hour later and see what they're doing. I mean, it's not – all you have to be sure of is that you don't boil the pan dry.
I think you have more time than I do.
Well, maybe.
Chickpeas cook really quickly, I find.
What determines whether beans cook quickly or not is how old and dry they are. Mm. So, you know, they can take 3 hours or they can cook in an hour.
Thank you so much for calling us. Well, if you're making a stock, you also want it to cook over a long time. But there's something wonderful about that smell when it has finally all come together. Sometimes I'll just put it on the stove with a very low flame overnight. I know some people don't think that's a good idea. But when I wake up in the morning, the odor is just so fabulous.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And you can do it in the oven also, in which case you've got a thermostat sort of regulating things for you. I don't think these are so much issues. If the last caller said I have more time than she does, but I'm a fairly busy person. It's a question of if you're at home, you multitask, and one of the tasks is cooking things that don't need a lot of attention. Beans and stocks don't need a lot of attention.
How much have the recipes in this book changed from the first How to Cook Everything?
Well, I think they're there's, as I said at the top of the show, there's a meat has been de-emphasized, not that there's no meat, but that there's less meat. I think the flavors are probably, if anything, more international and more pronounced.
We also can get those ingredients
ingredients, but I think also our taste buds have really gotten to the point where we like strong flavors. There's nothing wrong with that. And strong flavors can be as easy as lemons and garlic and chili and parsley, but 20 years ago, we weren't using as much of that stuff, I don't think.
A listener, Emmanuel, asks, do you have any comments about food which is difficult to digest, that is, stale bread and stews? He writes, I've heard stories that in medieval times they had no plates, just really stale bread instead, that everything was about prolonging the stew and using it on that bread. Is your body made to digest somewhat rotten food?
Well, there's a difference between stale bread and rotten food. I don't think our bodies are made to digest rotten food, but stale bread is easy enough to digest. You have to chew it or soak it in liquid.
Mm-hmm. You can also make your own breadcrumbs, and yet they sell breadcrumbs in the supermarket.
Well, you can make everything can be made at home, and almost everything
even
is
miso
made.
Soup.
Even miso soup. You didn't ask about miso soup.
Oh,
you asked about
miso.
No, miso soup is a snap. It's
miso,
like making
sorry
tea.
That I asked it
okay.
that way.
Miso soup is like making tea. Miso is like rocket science. But look, anything can be made at home. Everything is sold in the supermarket. The thing to remember is 75, 80, 90% of the stuff sold in the supermarket is processed to death, has ingredients you don't need, and as we were discussing before, probably has added sugar.
Mm-hmm. One of the discussions we had around Thanksgiving was whether canned pumpkin is as good as getting a pumpkin, roasting it, and you also get the seeds if you do it that way, but I do feel the flavor is different on almost all of those
things. Yeah, there are people who prefer canned pumpkin. I don't get it. I prefer butternut squash is what I prefer, or kabocha, which is really
fabulous.
And
Melissa Clark says her pumpkin pie is always really a squash, a butternut squash.
Well, that's interesting.
So I guess there are a lot of people like that.
Easier to deal with.
Uh-huh.
Better shape for cutting the skin off. Try cutting the skin off a pumpkin.
And nobody knows the difference?
I don't. Not 99 out of 100 people will not know the difference.
We're going to slip another call in here. Paula from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a recipe that I thought was for miso soup, but now I'm confused as to whether you have a recipe that's easy for miso soup or you don't. I thought somebody said that it was very difficult to make miso soup.
No, I thought Leonard was asking if we could make miso. And miso is extremely
itself.
Difficult to make, but miso soup is a snap. I mean, really, miso soup is almost as easy as taking a cup of water and stirring a teaspoon of miso into it. So.
Well, what I do is just saute onions and cabbage for a while and then take it out and then add the miso, and that's my miso soup.
Sounds great.
Or is that something is that not even miso soup?
Listen, it's your miso soup. It sounds terrific to me. Don't worry about it.
Well, I want to know what somebody else's
Somebody else's miso soup might be putting some kelp, seaweed in water, heating it gently, maybe a black mushroom or two, and uh-huh. then stirring miso into that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
But she brings up an interesting point, which is there are those people who want to do the pure thing, and then there are others who say, hey, these ingredients went together pretty well when I accidentally put them together last time. Maybe I should do this again.
This is one of the oldest arguments in cookbook writing, of course, and I fall on the side of people who don't believe there is a pure thing. So there are pure ingredients. Parmesan is Parmesan. Miso is miso. But there are as many recipes for miso soup as there are people cooking it, and yours is as good as anyone else's as far as I'm concerned.
Mark Bittman covers food policy, cooking, and eating as an opinion columnist and blogger for the New York Times, where he is also the Sunday Magazine's lead food writer. You find him, his columns right before the crossword puzzle at the end of the magazine.
The much more popular crossword puzzle.
He produced the Minimalist column for 13 years in the New York Times. He has a show on the Cooking Channel. He is a regular contributor to the Today Show. And he's written over a dozen cookbooks. And the most recent one is How to Cook Everything, The Basics, All You Need to Make Great Food. It has 1,000 photos and 180 recipes.
175 or so, yeah.
And it's published by Wiley in a large format with a lot of colored pictures.
Weighs a lot. As I like books that weigh a lot.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's great, Leonard.